Minto, New Jersey.
My name's Rainey Nelson. I'm an alcoholic. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to take one moment to remind myself that I need God to be here. Thanks. I'd really like to thank everybody else who's spoken so far today. Really just some unbelievable stuff, and no matter how many times I get into a spiritual body like this for a period of time, it never ceases to amaze me the power that seems to move around and the things that seem to happen just from being present with a group of people like this. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, and despite that fact, I have not found myself struck drunk since February 17th of 2000, and that is a miracle. And if you knew me before I got sober, you would agree, and you'd be about as happy about it as I am. Now, I'm not an alcoholic because of the way I drank. Okay. I drank alcoholically, but that's not what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is there's two things that go on. One is I suffer from something that I now know is alcoholism, and that was with me from my earliest memories. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, for whatever reason, and I don't know where it came from, I don't know if it was instilled in me by society, I don't know if I got it from my parents, I don't know if I read it in a book, I don't know if I just picked up this idea. But I picked up the idea that my role on this planet and in this universe was to make sure that I was happy and cared for, and that the only person that was going to do that was me. And the only way that I knew to do that was to formulate and carry out a plan. And so I began planning at a very early age. Now, for me, this is the beginnings of alcoholism. I grew up with two of the most well-adjusted, functional human beings as parents that I have ever seen. I was in a very dysfunctional home, but the dysfunction, oddly enough, was entirely because of me. When I became functional, it turns out my entire family really had it on the ball. I didn't see that when I was a kid. I would have told you a lot of problems. There was a while that I started really looking back and really looking at my childhood, trying to figure out what is it that was done to me, you know. And there was a period of time, a decade or so ago, when repressed memories were coming. Something must have happened to me, because for me to be where I am now, you know, obviously I've repressed something. And you know what? I don't remember much before I was 5 years old, so it must be back there, you know. And I would dig and dig, and I would talk to my parents and. My mother has a long history in psychology, and so we would play this game, and she said, you know, when you were 18 months old, I left you at the babysitter's, and I came back one day, and you were bawling your eyes out. You were crying for me, and maybe that was it. Maybe it's abandonment issues. And I, oh, yeah. She said, you know, we moved a lot. We moved a lot when you were a kid, and I went to something like 13 schools before I hit junior high school, and maybe that was it. Maybe that was the deal. You know, oh, yeah, maybe that was it. You know, I don't know. All I know is, by the time I'm 12 years old, I'm waking up every single morning to the Jerry Springer show is going on in the back of my head. And what's going on is I'm looking and I'm planning out the wreckage that I know is to come today, and how can I avoid it? How can I change it? How can I control it? What am I going to do about this? And so every day I'm waking up and I'm formulating a plan for the day. Now, at 12 years old, my big plan, and I'm going to use a lot of terminology here that I would never have used then, but in hindsight, looking back at it, I'm looking for the proper way to manage my life. I'm sure that I can force the world, by playing a really good game of chess, I can force the world to give me the satisfaction and happiness that I know is my birthright and that I'm here for. And so I get up in the morning and I got a plan. And at 12, the plan is usually something like, okay, new school. Let's go into the school. We got to look cool. We got to get people on our side right away, because if they're not on our side, they're going to talk about us. If they talk about us, they're going to start thinking at us. Chris, I always identify with that. Chris talked about that this morning. They're thinking at me. I know they're thinking at me. So I got to have some way to make sure that you're thinking good thoughts at me. Because that way I'll get reflected back at me that which is going to make me happy. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to go into school. You know, I'm going to find the kid that everyone picks on, right? The kid that everybody doesn't like, right? And I'm going to pick on him. And I'm going to be funny about it. And I'm going to be witty about it. And I'm going to find the teacher that everyone likes. And I'm going to make sure that I pay attention and that I'm cool in that class. I'm going to find the teacher that everyone doesn't like. And I'm going to, you know, whatever, throw spitballs at them so that I look cool. And I'm going to find the kid that looks like he might be tough, but I know I can take, and I'm going to get in a fight with him. And we're going to play kickball, and I'm going to score the win. And I got this entire list of things that I'm going to do in order to cause the world to give me satisfaction and happiness. And, you know, obviously, by the end of every day, I am just a beaten man. Because it's not that some of those things don't work out. The problem is, some of them don't. And everyone that doesn't is dashing me against the rocks of hopelessness yet again. And by 12, this has become an obsession. I mean, this is not something that I wake up and I go, I wonder what we'll do today. I wake up in the morning and literally I have a cast of characters going on in the back of my head, getting me out of bed, right? Telling me where we need to start and where we need to go today. And I am losing it. And 12 years old was one of the worst years I have ever experienced on this planet. And there was nothing wrong outside. That was my alcoholism, right? I didn't know that at the time. You couldn't have accurately diagnosed it at the time because there was one thing missing from the puzzle. But at 13, the alcoholism met the alcohol. Okay? And 13 was a marvelous year. 13 was it was magical, because when alcoholism and alcohol meet in the same place at the same time in my body, it's unbelievable what happens to a guy like me. And the first time I drank alcohol, Chris, if you got any of you guys who were here and heard Chris told my story to a T this morning, because I had this picture, right? Because I'm constantly on the lookout for new plan fodder. You know, what can I do? What can we add into the plan today? Maybe there's something I'm missing here. And somewhere along the line, I've started to see and hear and read and learn some things about what alcohol looks like, what it looks like when people drink. And they look like they're having fun. And I was always an avid reader because I wasn't allowed to watch television for whatever reason. My mother didn't like television very much. So if you got in trouble in my house, the first thing to go was TV. I didn't watch TV from age 7 on. It just wasn't allowed. I was always in some kind of trouble. So I read a lot. I used to read things that I had no business reading. For whatever reason, I loved Henry Miller. Now, at 12 years old, Henry Miller doesn't make sense to anybody. I don't know, it doesn't make, but the guy was drunk all the time. And he had these beautiful descriptions of the world. And even when things went wrong for him, you had this sense that he's won out. He's gotten what he wants. And so somewhere in the back of my head, I have this idea, alcohol looks like it might be a good part of the plan. I had no idea how right I was. 13 years old, a guy shows up at my house. I've just met this guy. He's the new kid in school, but I don't know him, so I have a much better shot at looking really cool to him than to all the people who have seen me pick the wrong guy to get into a fight with, who've seen me pick on the wrong teacher at the wrong day, who've seen me embarrassed and humiliated, because that happens. This guy comes to my house, shows up with a peace offering. You know, we're going to be friends. Let's hang out. We're 13 years old. You're not supposed to do this. So, whips out a gigantic bottle of vodka. Cool. You know, cool. I know you're not supposed to do it. I know it looks like fun. Let's try this out. And, you know, I don't know anything about chasers. I don't know anything. I'm just not a subtle guy. I never have been. I don't remain subtle to this day. If my sights are on something, I'm a bull. And I just go for it. And so I poured a water glass full of vodka. And I started drinking it. And it burned, man. It didn't taste very good. I didn't know what was going on. So what I do is I distract myself. Let's hum a song, you know, throw your head back, gulp the whole thing. I will never forget the look on this guy's face, Andy Snyder. I'll never forget the look on his face, because he starts drinking his straight glass, and he looks at me and he goes, and he just gets this look on his face like, my God, what are you doing? And I drank the whole thing, just like that. I just opened my throat, drank it, and I kicked back and I waited to see what this does. What's this about? What's going on? And, you know, about 5 minutes later, nothing's really happened. I got this weird burning sensation in my stomach. I got this weird taste in the back of my mouth. I'm thinking about maybe getting a breath mint or something. But nothing's happened yet, so obviously more is what's needed because we got to find it. So I do the rinse and repeat thing, and I do it again, and I wait. And at some point after the second gigantic glass of vodka, it happened. The alcoholism and the alcohol met. And they shook hands, they introduced themselves, and the sun rose somewhere in my body, and every cell in my being simultaneously just exhaled and relaxed about 30 degrees. And the best description I can give you of what happened to me is those promises that we hear at the beginning of the meeting, those night step promises, all of those things came true for me. I did not regret the past. I knew a level of serenity that I had never known before with my best friend, with the coolest guy I've ever met, Andy Snyder, and he's the coolest guy in the world because he brought me the new plan. This is now the plan. It's not part of the plan. It's not an ad. It's not a set. This is the plan, right? And but plus that, he's looking at me like I'm someone to be looked at, you know. And he's looking at me like, wow, you're really crazy. And I like being looked at like that. I like people looking at me that way. I blacked out. First time I drank, I blacked out. The book says that at some point in our drinking career, we all cross into this stage where we lose control over the amount that we take, right? Where the alcohol is now taking me. I'm not taking the alcohol anymore. And I was born across that line. All, you know, add water, add vodka, boom, you're there. I blacked out the first night, got into a fight with a street sign, got picked up by the police trying to go to a movie at 3:30 in the morning, 3 miles from my house. My parents came and picked me up, got grounded for 3 weeks. Greatest night of my life. Best night of my life. My hand has never been the same. I cherish the fact that I have this one knuckle that's a little weird from losing a fight with a street sign. I think that that's just one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. Now, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a complete idiot. So it's not like I set about drinking 24/7 every day from there on out. I understand that I need to make you happy so that you'll leave me alone. So I will do the bare minimum. You know, I will show up at school. You know, I will pretend to do my homework. You know, I will go out to the mailbox and collect any letter that's coming from the school so that my parents don't find it. And I will find every chance that I can to go into New York City, to go to the party, to sneak into the liquor cabinet, to do whatever it takes to get drunk. And that's fine. And to tell you the truth, in the beginning, I could go weeks at a time in the alcoholism, in the spiritual malady, in the discomfort, knowing that there's an end to it. Knowing that once Friday night comes, this will all have been worth it. You know, and I will crawl through miles of broken glass to get to a drink because it's the only thing that makes me feel okay, and it worked, man. It absolutely worked for me. I never tried to keep away from it. By the way, I had a very hard time when I showed up here getting the idea of being physically powerless. That was really hard for me to understand. It was hard for me to understand this idea of an allergy that I didn't have control over the amount I took, because the fact is that every time I drank, I wanted to be obliterated and I wanted to black out. You know, when I talk about going out to party, I don't use words that describe having fun and I want to go out and blossom tonight. No, I want to go out and get obliterated. I want to go out and be destroyed. I use terms of destruction because really that's what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is to get rid of what lives in here. I want to escape it. And so they told me, you know, when you drank, did you have control over the amount that you took? Did you ever drink more than you wanted to? No, because I wanted to get so wasted I couldn't think straight. But the truth of the matter is, I'm not a big dude. You give me a six-pack fast, I'm pretty obliterated. You know, when I got a huge tolerance, maybe it was 12. You know, 3 Long Island iced teas at happy hour, and I'm really in bad shape. What I didn't want was the other 30, or however many. I don't know how many I drank. I wanted to be obliterated and wasted, but I didn't want to wake up naked in a pool of urine on somebody's coffee table. That's not what I wanted to do. I overshot that mark. No matter how far out I was setting the mark, I overshot it every time. Every time. And when I really dug at it, there were a few times that I wanted to drink to loosen up a little bit. There's one moment that I always remember. I had this new girlfriend, and she has older brothers, and they're in college, and they both played football, and I'm a little nervous about meeting these guys. Italian family. I'm a little nervous about meeting these guys. And I decide that, okay, you know what, I'm not going to get completely stupid here, right? I'm not going out to get wasted. I'm trying to make a good impression. However, I also can't go wound up and tense. So I need to have a couple of drinks. I mean, it makes sense, right? Just two or three drinks, a glass of wine, you know, and that's all I'm looking to do because I have purpose and direction this evening. My purpose and direction is to make friends and manipulate my new girlfriend's brothers into not wanting to kill me, right? Once again, I woke up that night. It was a laundry room. I woke up in a laundry room. That relationship didn't last. It didn't survive that night because I drank until I got this warm, fuzzy feeling, and I can remember a brief interval where I'm chatting it up with her brothers, and we're getting along, we're laughing, we're having a good time, and we're going to get another round, and the next thing I know, I'm not welcome ever again. And that's it. And I don't know what happened. I don't know how that happened. And so I can look back, and my experience abundantly confirms me that, yes, you know what, no matter what I wanted to do, for me, beginning the process of drinking is like jumping off a 20-story building, and trying to stop before I hit ground is not going to happen. And for me, when I get separated, it's because something has separated me. It's because I've blacked out or something has physically restrained me. I'm locked up. I'm in a hospital. Something has separated me from alcohol, and that's the way it always goes. I do not have any conscious memory of beginning to drink, getting that click, that feeling when the alcohol kicks in, and deciding to stop. I don't ever remember doing that. There are times that I drank a half a beer and clamped down on myself. There was no effect of alcohol. Now that doesn't count as far as I'm concerned. Right? If the alcohol effect enters my body, I'm seeing it through till the end. And the end is not something I have control over. And I got my hands around that and I understood that. And just fill in your own war stories, okay? There was the jails, there was the institution. Somehow I never got a DUI. I still don't know how. I should have, but for whatever reason, I don't know, God decided I needed to have a clean driving record for some reason. Everything else, I'm a multiple convicted felon in several states. I was listening to Ginny talk, and I was thinking to myself, man, I should have got myself an Al-Anon, because they all left me. And I'm thinking, God, somebody that would hang around through all that, that's what I was missing. That's what I was missing. Because right about when you came into Al-Anon, that's about when I started contributing to other people needing to go to Al-Anon. I left a trail. I left a wreckage. I left bodies. I am not very good influence on the people around me. The people that care about me pay. They pay dearly. When I was in my late 20s, you know, you can imagine the kind of crap that's going on. I joined the military. I saw the world. I'll tell you what I remember of the world. The clearest memory I have of seeing the world was Guam. And I'll tell you what I remember about Guam. I just met a guy who was stationed in Guam, and I asked him, I said, "What's there's this bar in Guam, and it's on the beach, and there's volleyball nets, and I don't remember anything else about it except they serve drinks in pails. And the straws are this big around." And he went, "Johnny and Bob," whatever the name was. He knew exactly what it was. That's what I remember. I saw parts of the world at the time that very few people got to see. And I remember the place with the gigantic straws. You know, that's what I remember. It just got worse. It got horrendously ugly. I'm not one of those people that have one too many martinis and embarrass themselves at the business lunch. You know, I'm the guy who, at 30 years old, if you see me on the street, you're on the other side of the street and you're still going to check your wallet. You know, you need to make sure. And I'm a very weird shade of yellow that doesn't quite make sense. I weigh about 60 pounds, literally less than I weigh now. And I'm a frightening, frightening sight. And nobody wants to talk to or be around me. I believed, because when I was in rehab, I remember hearing people talk, and I thought, you know, my mom must have been afraid that I was going to die. And in the process of amends, I got to find out the truth of the matter was she got past afraid I was going to die when I was about 21. By the time I was 30, she was firmly in the area of, please just die and get it over with. I'm tired of watching this. I am awake enough to have some sense of what that must be like, to wish that your child would die because it's more painful to watch them alive. By 30, I used to describe myself as a chronic relapser. It's not accurate, though. The truth of the matter is I was a lapser. I was an extended lapser. I came into AA meetings. There were periods of time that I was locked up somewhere that I would stifle down and I would keep the alcohol and the non-conference approved substances out of my body for a brief period of time because I did a lot of those. I want to talk about my experience with AA, and then I'll get into what I believe emotional sobriety is about. I want to start with when I started coming to AA very serious and very intending to stop for good, just as I need to stop. When I was about 30, I've been through multiple detoxes. I've begun multiple rehabs. I didn't finish any of them because they want to keep you there long past the point where you're actually sleeping at night. And I'm coming to AA, and I'm starting to get the sense that, you know what, I can't do just a little. The marijuana maintenance plan is not going to work for me. I need to give up everything. I need to give it up forever, and I'm willing to do that. And in fact, I'm willing to do whatever you tell me. And every time I would come and I would go to some meetings and I would meet some people and I would get drunk as a skunk within 3 days and I would be gone for a period of time and I would come back. Every time I would come back a little more willing. The end of 1999, I am so willing that I did 90 meetings in 90 days, and I got a sponsor that I talked to every single day. I was at least one meeting a day. I had 2 coffee commitments a week, and I never stayed sober for 3 days at a time. Everything that I believed I was supposed to be doing. I was talking a little bit with Tom before, and meeting makers make it. I made a lot of meetings, man. I made a lot of meetings. And for me, if I'm a meeting maker and that's all I am, I'm losing my mind. And I don't lose it slowly. And I work with a lot of people and I know a lot of people, and some of the people closest to me are people who have come into sobriety, been sober for a period of time, and then bottomed out emotionally. And then they find this path to this place that's extraordinary. Me, I bottomed out without ever getting sober. I can't do it. I don't know. For whatever reason, that was the plan for me. At the end of 1999, I've done about 4 months going to AA constantly, really doing, I mean, doing, and I, everything that was asked of me, I did. I went to step meetings to learn the work, the steps. I had no idea what you were talking about. The only thing I learned from the step meetings I went to, and again, I don't know what was said, but what I internalized, what I understood was that I have to get the first step perfectly every day. Now, what does that mean to me? That means I get up every morning and I say to myself, you're an alcoholic. You can't drink today. But right off the bat, fundamental misunderstanding. What I should have been saying to myself is, you're an alcoholic. You're going to drink. That's it. But no, today I am deciding I'm not going to drink no matter what. And if some piece of my anatomy falls off, I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to drag it to the meeting and I'm going to make some coffee and put away chairs. And I call my sponsor and tell him, made that decision, I did it. More often than not, I'm drunk by 3 in the afternoon. It's just the way it is. I know the end's in sight again. I'm caught in the stages of the spree, and I know that the end of the spree is coming, and the end of the spree is a drag for me. It's a drag. And I can't go through this sobriety thing again. There's no hope in that. There's nothing for me. You obviously have misunderstood, because when I was 12 years old, I was in agony, and I found the one thing on this planet that allowed me to exist somewhat peacefully. And now you're going to take my medication away and tell me that everything's going to get better. You're wrong. You're wrong. And my experience is it doesn't get better, not for a guy like me. I believe that there's a lot of people it does. More power to you. Fortunately, those people can't sponsor me. I can't have that person as my sponsor. We can hang out. We can talk. Some of those people are very spiritually awake. Some of those people are tremendously into service. Some of my best friends are that way. We can meet, discuss how wonderful the universe is, how great things have gotten as a result of AA. But if I'm up against it, you're not the guy I need to be talking to. We don't have the same issues. We don't seem to have the same problem. So I know it's going down, and I'm about to run out of money, and I'm about to be in a terrible state, and I have nowhere to go, and I have smoked too many cigarettes and lit too many fires in my parents' basement watching Star Trek again, and I know that I'm getting tossed out of there, and I know the last time's coming up, and this is just for me, okay? As far as I'm concerned, death is nothing to be afraid of. It never has for me. The only thing that has ever, and to this day, frightened me even a little about death is that I think there's a good chance that for a few minutes beforehand, I'm going to be in pain. And I don't want to go through that. The pain frightens me. The dead, no, that's just the game over button. Just check me out. Time to go. So I decided to check out. I used to call it the Keystone Cops suicide caper. I made a very strong, every ounce of power, willpower, marshaling all the forces of my will together, I tried to end my life. And I tried very hard, and it was not a cry for help. I didn't want your help. You tried to help me. You can't help me. You know, I am not helpable. And I understood this in a gut level. I understood this where I live. The concession to my innermost self has happened. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not something I do for myself. It's not something you can convince me of. It's something that either happens to me or not. You may be able to guide me towards seeing that, but you can't make that happen for me. And I can't convince myself of it. And at this point, it's happened. I know I'm hopeless. I'm hopeless and I'm helpless. And I don't have anywhere else to turn. And the idea of turning somewhere else, I had heard, this is what I gleaned from all of my wonderful step meeting experience about the second and third step. You must get the God thing. All right, what does that mean? Well, I don't know, you got to get with the God thing. Say a prayer. Now, prayers don't look right to me. Because when I hear people talk about praying, it sounds to me like you're trying to get this God to do your will. What's that all about? You know, and if it's going to do my will, why do I need it? Why can't I do it myself? This seems silly. I can't get with the God thing. So I got nowhere to turn. I got nothing left, man. I am done. I'm wiped out. I am powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. And personally, for me, I'm powerless over death. I can't die. And I'll tell you flat out, I tried. And the depths of despair for me are coming to realizing I'm still alive again. And what am I going to do now? I wound up doing 6 weeks in a 4-week rehab, leaving. Now, I went into this rehab just desperate, man. And there were a group of people around, the kind of people that organized days like this, a group of people that were involved in the Burnsville group, some people that had some direct experience with the steps, and some people that were my kind of lunatic alcoholics, and I needed that. And they were not, they did not appear to love me the same way everyone else did. They didn't tell me, just keep coming back, it's going to be okay, and it really ticked me off. There was one guy in particular who had no problem coming into a meeting and pointing at me in the middle of the meeting and cross-talking. You guys may be able to skip a 4-step, but you're killing this kid. And he would look at me and he would pause. So I would know he was looking at me, and I would think, and I would look at this guy, and I would think, you're not, I'm here 2 months, and I know you're not supposed to do that. What are you doing here? And I would think that, arrogant, and I would hunt around for the people that would hang out and take his inventory with me after the meeting, and we would take his inventory. I still know that man to this day, and he is one of the finest examples of AA and sobriety that I ever hope to meet. And he had no problem. He had no problem with pissing me off because he loved me. He had no problem getting in my face. It didn't bother him in the slightest. He loved me so much, he didn't even know me. He didn't even know me. He looked in my eyes. He looked at my skinny, pathetic little self coming back again. And he loved me so much that he was willing to piss me off. So I'm in this 6-week program, and consequently, every Thursday night, this guy's coming in, bringing a meeting. And in the rehab, he's pointing at me. In the rehab. First 3 weeks there, they wouldn't let me go to meetings. You know, I wasn't capable of it. I didn't sleep for 3 weeks. I couldn't control my bodily functions for 3 weeks. I was useless. That's why I was there 6 weeks, because I didn't even begin the rehab part of things. And I would go downstairs, and I started putting on weight. You know, the girls are looking at me again, right? People are talking, I'm sounding good. I've been to a lot of meetings. I know how this goes. You know, the 10 minutes before the meeting, you sit down, you get a quiet place, and you figure out what your problem du jour is so you have something to share. And I'm going to come, and I'm going to give you my problem for the day so you can clean it up for me, and I'm helping your sobriety. And I'm getting some attention. And this guy's in this meeting carrying this fundamental AA meeting into this rehab, pointing at me, going, you guys want to wind up like him? Because if you're in this place messing around, talking to the girlies, I had dyed my hair blonde because I was bored. Dyeing your hair blonde, you're probably in trouble. And it pissed me off so much. I went up to after the meeting. I said, what is the problem you have with me? I said, dude, why is it? You know, I'm here. I'm doing what they ask of me. He's like, because I care about you, man. And one day, you and I are going to be spiritual brothers. And why are you going to go say something like that to me? I just had a real clear picture in my head of who you are, why I don't like you, why I'm better than you. And you got to go say something like that to me. And I started talking to him. And he hooked me up with the man who was my first sponsor. And they hooked me up with some Joe and Charlie tapes. And there was a counselor in that rehab that started talking to me. And I started getting real serious, and I'm going to go to the meetings every day, and I'm going to do, and this is what I must do to keep myself sober. You know, I must go to the meeting every day, I must work the 12 steps, I must read the big book, I must have a sponsor, and this is, did you hear what I said? This is what I must do to keep myself sober. And I left that rehab after 6 weeks, and I went to a long-term treatment facility where they were going to help me to learn some life skills, and within 24 hours, I'm loaded up again. I had no idea how that happened. I went to a meeting that morning. I prayed that morning. Every single tool that anybody had ever offered me to keep myself sober, I had done that day by noon. And I don't know how it happens. Now, I can't live. I can't die. I can't stay sober. I can't get drunk. I'm out. I went crawling back to the same rehab. They gave me a blood and breathalyzer test to get back into the rehab because they didn't believe that I had actually gotten drunk that day. It's the only time anybody's ever given me a test hoping, and I'm going, man, I hope it actually shows up because otherwise I'm in serious trouble. And I spent another 6 weeks there. What time am I going to, 45 or 30? I listened to those Joe and Charlie tapes. I went to a long-term halfway house. Best thing that ever happened to me. Not because there was anything wonderful about the halfway house, because it was an extended period of time where I was kept so busy, I didn't have time to think so much. You know, I was exhausted all the time. I was busy all the time. And for whatever reason, I had died at the end of 1999. And I mean that. Something in me had died, never, ever to come back. And I knew, man, I know you opened those doors for me, and I know I'm in deep, deep trouble. And the only thing I have to give a shot at is this stupid book, these stupid things that they're talking about on this stupid tape. And I'm doing it. And to tell you the truth, I had a sponsor at the time. He didn't guide me through that book. Wasn't what he did. Wonderful man. I would get into the car with him, and I would start to open my mouth to talk about a problem, and he would just be talking. This guy was connected to God in a way that was incredible. He would just start talking and telling me what was going on and answering my questions without even me saying anything. He didn't even know what to do. He'd say, I don't know where this is coming from, but I just feel like I'm supposed to talk about this, and blah, 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 blah. Astonishing. Astonishing. I did a fourth step. I shared it with my counselor in that place, and I shared it with my sponsor. My fifth step with that sponsor consisted of, I was so nervous. He said, you know what, just tell me the worst thing on there. And I told him when I was about 28 years old, I stole $15 out of my 12-year-old sister's piggy bank, and it's eaten me up. He said, all right, fine, let's go get some coffee. That was my fifth step. Was it perfect? No. No. Was it mechanical? Yeah, absolutely. I did it mechanically. I made an eight-step list. I told him about it, and he would say, yeah, it's fine. Say, you know, I'm going to do this amends with my mom. I'm going to sit down and talk to my mom. You know, I'm going to call Jerry from the West Coast. And I went and I did everything I could do, man. To the utmost of my ability at that time, given what I knew, I made direct amends to the people that I could, you know. And I became clear on the people I couldn't find. And I left that facility and I was scared, but I was really hoping something had happened. And I don't know, was I okay? Was I not okay? Was I changed? Was I not changed? To be honest with you, I hadn't even bothered to ask myself that question yet. And about 9 months sober, I sat in a meeting one night, and there was a woman who was coming back again, and she was talking about, when am I going to have my spiritual awakening? What's going to happen? And I thought to myself, you know, I've done these things that are supposed to be done, and I understand now that those promises are ninth step promises, and I've done everything I can with that ninth step, and I'm living in 10 and 11, and I just started sponsoring someone, you know, at 9 months sober, and have I had a spiritual awakening? And I went through those ninth step promises in my head. It's the only thing I knew to do. And sitting in that meeting, at that moment, for the first time in my life, I suddenly realized that something had done for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I couldn't do it, you couldn't do it, everybody's tried, man, the entire planet. You know, if somebody had come up with a list of what needs to happen, it would have been, you know, world peace, feed the hungry, and let's get Rainey fixed up, man, because that guy's in some serious, serious trouble. You know, if there was a way to do it, it would have been done. And suddenly, something had shifted, and I got this incredible sense of peace. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and I've never been able to talk about this without getting that chill feeling. If you can remember the first time that you realized God had shown up in no uncertain terms, it's a mind-blowing experience, man. And I'm looking around the room to see if everybody else has felt it, because it just got 5 degrees warmer and breezy at the same time in here. Did you see that? Like what? And, you know, nobody else had noticed anything, but it had happened to me. About 6 months later, I started doing things like going back to the treatment facility I was in every Thursday night and carrying the same message that was carried to me to other people. And I started attending a group where people were dead serious about the steps. And I started hearing all of these things that they were talking about. You know what it was? They were talking about the ninth step, and they wrote cards out. And they had these three questions on the cards. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I didn't do that. Did I do this right? Here's where my emotional insecurity started coming in. Spiritually awake. I'm awake at this point. I was changed. There's no two ways around it. I know it. I'm clear on it. But emotionally, I still have all this stuff going on. There's still this maw, this turmoil that doesn't just go away immediately or on its own. It just doesn't, you know. I can be okay with it, but it doesn't. And I'm looking around and I'm going, what do I do? What do I do? And I got introduced to a gentleman. And I asked him to take me through the steps, and I explained what had happened. I explained to him, listen, I believe I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I didn't believe that there was anything like God, and now I know there's something there. But I'm also understanding that maybe there's more to this deal. You know, and I'm a year and a half sober, and things are good, but I want to know if there's more, and can you help me? And he took me through the steps, not the way I thought I was going to be taken through. You know, we used the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went through. I was asked to do a lot of reflection. I was asked to write a different type of inventory. You know, you did this inventory, let's do another one, let's see what's going on. And the first time I think was my mechanical trip through the steps. And what I mean by that was my period of time going through a process which would wake me up to what was there. The second time I went through the steps, it was a powerful, powerful experience, man. And it wasn't that anything changed, it was that my consciousness that this had happened to me. My consciousness that not only had it happened to me, it was available all the time to anyone. And it was always there. And I could go as far as I wanted to go with it. That all started to happen to me. And I started to have these incredible realizations. I had sponsored a couple of people before then. The first person I ever sponsored died. I went on vacation on a Friday. On that Friday afternoon, he left the halfway house he was in, checked into a hotel room with a prostitute and a pocket full of drugs, OD'd and died. And I had to get over the idea that I have to do with what happens to these people very quickly, because I'm thinking, what did I do wrong? I did what I could. I'm not supposed to save this guy's life. You know, I'd sponsored a few people, and I remember saying to this guy who was taking me through the work, saying, you know, I feel like I need to be of more help to people, and I don't know how to do that. And he kind of looked at me. I say this to people all the time, and he said, you know, don't you worry. You're going to have people beating your door down looking for help. And I'm thinking, man, that's not going to happen to me. You know, that's what happened to me. I have had more opportunities to be of service to people than I know what to do with. You know, that's the truth of the matter. And the other thing that's really interesting is the worst things seem to be getting for me. If I'm having something that's causing me trouble, I was unemployed for about a six-month period of time, and I was really trying not to be unemployed. You know, and I'm letting it go, and I'm turning it over, but I'm sending out resumes, and I hit a brick wall around that, and I have this prayer that I say. It's just something that was, I don't know if it was taught to me or if I picked it up or what, but this prayer is, okay, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm done. This is not my problem anymore, because I've done everything I know to do, and obviously there's something in it for me. And my assumption is that your will for me is better than my will for me, so you know what? You take care of the job situation. You want me to do something, let me know, and I'll do it, right? But until then, you send me somebody to help you. You fix my job situation. And I got people coming looking for help. I got opportunities to be of service out of the wazoo. And over this period of time, what happened to me is it made sense to me, if I look at this intellectually, what needs to happen is I need to get physically straightened out because I was a mess when I got here. And then we need to get my head straightened out. We need to stop this insanity that's going on in the back of my head, you know? And then we need to calm down this emotional turmoil so that I can get to work on this spirituality thing, you know? Now that makes complete sense to my mind, my intellectual brain. That's got to be the way it is, you know? And the truth of the matter is, what I needed to do and what happened to me is I threw myself into the spiritual part of this deal because it was the only thing I knew to do. And every bit of direction I was getting along the way was about spiritual growth, never about my physical, never about my mind, never about my emotional. And what happened is my body straightened out relatively quickly. It shouldn't have. It shouldn't have. My body should be, I shouldn't have an arm, my liver should be falling out, I shouldn't be walking most of the time. Somewhere along the line, my mind, by the time I was 9 months sober, I woke up and I realized, yeah, my mind still chatters. And that's the deal, is my mind still chatters, but it doesn't run me anymore. And there's part of me listening to it as it's talking. So I must not be my mind. And I started realizing, I'm not my thoughts. The mind is just part of me. That's not who I really am. Holy cow, this is astonishing. My mind starts to straighten out. Somewhere through that first process of the steps, the shift started to happen where I started off going through this process because I need to be okay and because I'm so screwed. But somewhere along the line, and I can't tell you where, but I can tell you by the time I was through with my ninth step, this shift had happened where it was no longer about I need to feel good. It was suddenly about I need to be useful to people. I need the purpose and direction of being able to be of use to you because I've started to see clearly when I'm being of use to you, everything's cool for me. Everything's cool for me. As soon as I start to do for me, I'm in deep, deep trouble. And physically, I straightened out very quickly. Mentally, I straightened out. The first time I started looking, I wonder how I'm doing mentally. My mental state had completely changed. You know, the chatter had cut down a lot, and the chatter wasn't running me anymore. My emotional well-being took quite a bit longer. As far as I'm concerned, I had this long sort of debate with myself about what's thinking, what's emotion, what's emotion, what's thinking, what's thinking, what's emotion. As far as I'm concerned, emotion for me, what my emotions are is that's, emotions are the currency of my consciousness. That's what my experience is. I experience my emotions. And then my ego steps in and puts words on it and chatters about it, and that's my mind. Those things are linked, but they're not quite the same for me. Now, when my mind stopped chattering away so much, I still have these emotions, and I'm not able to label them the way I used to. I used to be able to say, like, this is fear, and this is anger, and this is jealousy, and they all funnel into rage, and that's what we get. And suddenly, I'm noticing more and more over a period of time, noticing that there's this feeling going on in me, and I can't say what it is. I can tell you where it is in my body. I can tell you what color it is, but I can't name it anymore. You know, and I started thinking back to, you know, I did one of those outpatient programs, and somebody this morning was talking about it. And I can remember they gave us this little sheet with a bunch of little smiley faces on it. You know, this is the jealous face. This is the happy face. There's about 60 faces in there to help me name my emotions. You know what? I do not need to name my emotions. Flat out, the last thing I need to do is name my emotions. The last thing I need is another word. That's what my mind does. My mind takes a snapshot of experience, and then it pulls me off into a back room somewhere so we can spend the next 20 years looking at this and not living. And I can't sit with what's actually going on within me. Beth was talking. I was so taken with this, the idea of this two-year-old having all these emotions go on and having no problem with that. This is what we are. This is what humanity is. It's about having these emotional experiences. But when I start naming them, I'm only naming them for one reason, so I can control them and I can make a plan about them. Because as soon as I can label it anger, I can go, okay, that's anger. And this is what we need to do about that. We need to go down in the basement with a wiffle ball bat and hit the wall for a while, because we learned that one. You know, that's how you deal with anger. You got to let it out. You can't repress it. You can't bottle it up. And I'm having a conversation about it rather than just looking at the fact that, oh, that guy cut me off in traffic, and there's the anger, and it comes up. And holy cow, yeah, I'm angry. Boy, isn't that funny that I'm so angry just because this guy got in front of me, and then it's gone. It's come up, and it's passed. and they come and they go. And that's okay. I used to think there's a line that I focused on real early on page 52, this spiritual malady, right? The bedevilments. It says we couldn't control our emotional nature, you know? Somewhere along the line, I decided, well, then the goal must be to control my emotional nature. It's not. I can't control it today. I don't need to control it. My emotions are there for a reason, you know? Now, don't get me wrong. They are nowhere near the tornado that they used to be. But I can't experience an emotion without the emotion owning me. You know, I can experience it and I can sit with it. You know, and I can have that experience. And I'm trying very hard to learn not to need to talk it to death. You know what happened to me today? I was in the car on the way over here and somebody cut me off and I got this anger. I think that helps for some reason. There's some part of me that thinks that if I can talk to you about it long enough, that if you'll pay attention, if I can drag you into my snapshot, that somehow that's going to help me. And it isn't. It isn't. These are just what happens to me. And as near as I can tell, the only thing that I need to do, now this is not an easy thing, but the only thing that I need to do is I need to stop worrying so much about me again. Again, I need to stop worrying so much about me. I need to try and see what I can do for you. Now, in order to be able to effectively do that, I have been through the steps a few times. I am currently going through the steps again in a very odd way. And I don't have time to go into detail about it, but the truth of the matter is I don't have any power over what pace, when, or how I go through the steps. The best I can hope to do is to submit to somebody who's guiding me through them and hope that I'll be able to get somewhere with that and to be honest about what's going on with it. And so I'm now back at step one or preparation for step one. With some meditation. And the meditation that I've been working with lately on this is, I am powerless over my own will to choose anything but my ego. And wow, that's a heavy one, man. I'm really getting, I have no choice over whether I admit my powerlessness. I have no choice over whether I see it. The only thing I can do is try to be of use to you. Now, when I first woke up and I realized, you know, suddenly, it's as though suddenly God appeared, and it was deep down within me, this great fact, as though suddenly this light went on. And that's how I experienced it internally. Externally, I experienced it as suddenly Quick Check started hiring much nicer people. The gas station attendants, the gas station attendants are no longer cranky. My mom and my dad have suddenly become pillars of wisdom. You know, and I experienced it both as there's this good feeling inside, but it seemed to me that the entire world had changed, that literally it had changed. And I think the answer is it's part of both. I do believe that I alter the world by who I am. I don't think it's just merely my perception, although that's a huge thing. I think that my perception alters who I am, and who I am has an effect on who you are. You know, and I've noticed this, somebody cranky comes into my path, it tends to bring stuff up in me, but when I meet those people, when you meet these people, sometimes you meet these people in AA who are just, the second you meet them, you just go like, wow, I like being around this guy, that woman is incredible to be near, you know, and I believe that I do have an effect on the world around me. I made the mistake of thinking that God wasn't there before, God's there now. You know, I have no idea what God is, and I need to say this. The only reason I use the word God is, first of all, because it's short, and it gets really boring saying my higher power, who I choose to call the force that guides the universe. I don't need a lot of words about it. The other reason I say God is because I couldn't 6 years ago. I couldn't say it with a straight face and talk about it, okay? Please don't misunderstand and think that I mean anything other than the God of my own misunderstanding. You know, my own extraordinarily limited, hopefully to become more limited over time, understanding. Because I don't need to understand it. I need to be in touch with it. And so I thought for a while that what had happened was God had suddenly entered me. You know? And I heard a speaker, a guy named Sandy B., talk about this. And the way he put this blew me away. And he talked about this, the prayer of St. Francis. And he said that the idea of the prayer of St. Francis is to be this channel, to be this instrument. You know, and the book says that God needs to work in and through us. Faith needs to work in and through us every day. Okay, and so it's not that God needs to be present in me. If God is everything, God is not everything that I like. You know, God is not everything except axe murderers. You know, God is not everything except my ego. You know, God is everything or God is nothing. And so the problem is, if God is not operating through me, I'm in trouble. I'm not experiencing it. And what this guy Sandy pointed out, I never thought of it, was that the blockage in that path, in that channel, is not the God in, it's the me out. It's me. I have blocked off my ability to carry these things to you because of my own self-centered fear, because of my own paying attention to me and my being a victim of this delusion that I'm supposed to and am capable of removing satisfaction and happiness out of the world. I am a victim of that delusion, which makes me a slave to myself. And I'm in agony because of it. Man, that is a painful, painful existence. And I have no power to get out of that. I don't even have a power to see it. And if I can do my best to keep that channel open from me towards you, the flow is always there. It doesn't mean I'm always comfortable. You know, it doesn't mean I'm always comfortable because some of my emotions are not emotions that I necessarily want to experience. But I can allow them to happen. You know, I can allow that to go on. You know, I can observe it and try. And believe me, this is a massive struggle for me. I am way, way more intelligent than I should be. I am going to kill myself. I'm overeducated far, far beyond my capacity. But I can try to not need to name it. I can sit with it and experience it instead of needing to name it and talk about it and take a picture of it and carry it around with me like it's my war wound. You know, I can try and stop living back there, and I can just observe it and watch this happen. And it's an extraordinary way of life, because then I get to talk to you and hear what you're talking about, and there's part of me that resonates with that. You know, there's part of me going like, oh yeah, I know what that is. You know, and sometimes we can talk about it, sometimes we just don't need to. You know, but my ability to connect with you like that, that's what I was looking for. That's what I was always looking for, is some way to connect with what's going on around me, to feel like I'm part of this thing that I'm living in, to feel whole, to feel whole. And I'm just a part, so if I'm just experiencing me, I'm done. I'm done for. I'm feeling cut off. My internal and external experience of the world is really magnificent most of the time. I need to continue to grow. We were talking, Tom and I spoke a little about this before this, and it's something that's so true for me, and it was beaten into me. The idea of maintenance of my spiritual condition is dangerous for me. I don't need maintenance. I need growth. I need to be moving forward with this all the time. You know, maintenance is what I did when I was drinking, you know, and I know where that brings me. I need to continue to grow and to continue to move forward. And that's my job. That's why I'm here. And if I'm working toward that, I know I'm okay. And I have this arrangement with my higher power that says, I don't know what you want. I don't know where I'm supposed to go. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. But it's my belief that if I am, and I use the circle and triangle, if I'm consistent about my unity with alcoholics and with all the people around me, and I'm trying to be of service to the people around me, and I'm trying my best to live in these disciplines and use these tools that you've given me, then I believe that you'll keep me safe and protected whether I feel good or not. And if you want me to do something else, I believe you'll show me that. That's my deal, you know, because I don't know what else to do, and I haven't been proven wrong yet. And, you know, being able to come into a room like this with, I'm going to assume that some of you guys are the kind of a whirlwind that I was. And, you know, just the amount of wreckage that we could have just inflicted on West Orange in the last 4 hours, if you cut us loose, is extraordinary, man. And instead, what are we doing? We're here and we're trying to connect and talk about God and trying to get with each other and trying to move forward. And that's an incredible thing. And I don't deserve to be a part of that, but I am. And that's cool. And that's cool. And I think that's the deal. No matter where I've been, there is no justice in the world, thank God. Thank God, there's nothing but mercy if I'm looking for it. Because if there's justice, I'm screwed. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here. This has been an incredible day, and I hope all of you have a wonderful day, and I hope all of you are experiencing conscious contact with your higher power. And thanks.